Bitcoin is not for everyone, it's for anyone. And there's a distinction there. Anyone willing to do the work, taking control of your keys, running your node and all of that stuff. Second layer Bitcoin and custodial Bitcoin is probably for everyone, but proper on-chain Bitcoin, it'll probably be for the few. And now we're in for a way, 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 way worse crisis. And the only lifeboat is Bitcoin. Number go up is one thing, but there might be a point in the future called number go absolutely bonkers. And that's when you get this snowball effect and all the fiat currencies start hyperinflating and it just goes berserk.
In my mind, everything is already hyperinflated in Bitcoin terms. People just don't understand or realize it yet.
They managed to keep the bubble alive for longer this time around, but it's, a crash is inevitable in my mind.
Down a rabbit hole. Down. Cypherpunk.
Welcome back to another episode of Cypherpunk. I'm here today with Knut Sonholm, and we are going to discuss episode 10 in our series on his book, Everything Divided by 21 Million. Let's kick this off and talk a little bit about adoption here. Obviously, this is the one metric that Bitcoin is behind on, right? I mean, like, adoption is other monies, fiat money is largely massively adopted, but Bitcoin is still in the very early phases of adoption.
Yeah. Because most people obey whatever the government tells them to do because they're afraid to be thrown in jail if they do otherwise. And most governments are hostile to Bitcoin because they don't know better. We would all be better off, including the so-called elites, if we had Bitcoin adoption everywhere. And it's important, let me ask you this. What's more important, that more money in Bitcoin or more people in Bitcoin?
More people, of course.
Yeah, I think it's a tricky question because, in my opinion, Bitcoin is not for everyone, it's for anyone. And there's a distinction there.
What's the distinction? Because it seems like the same thing to me.
It's for anyone willing to do the work required to actually understand it and take the leap and adopt it properly. Taking control over your keys and running your node and all of that stuff, which is not for everyone because it's too complicated for everyone. From a certain perspective, I think it's more important that, you know, ethically sound people who are curious and bold enough to adopt this new technology that they adopt Bitcoin than that your average Joe does or your mother does. Like, it's going to take a long time. Mm-hmm. I mean, Bitcoin, second layer Bitcoin and custodial Bitcoin is probably for everyone, but proper on-chain Bitcoin, like, if you divide the 21 million by 8 billion people, we all get 230,000 sats each. And if you take an average human lifespan to be 80 years, we all get to do 2 on-chain transactions each.
Yeah.
So it has to scale in layers, and it has to scale by other means than just on-chain adoption.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a on-chain layer one. In the future, not everybody will be able to adopt on that level, right? I mean, you'll have to.
No, it'll probably be for the few.
When we think about adoption, a common thing we look at when we're talking about, like, disruptive technologies is this idea of an S-curve of adoption.
Yeah.
How do you feel about Bitcoin's S-curve of adoption? Where do you think we are on that S-curve? And do you think we're going to follow the S-curve? Do you think it will be a J-curve?
Yeah, it's or what's this curve called?
Which curve?
Like, first the end of the S and then going up again.
Oh.
So there are many theories here. And when we talk about S-curve adoption, like, if you look at all technologies that get adopted by most of humanity, they follow an S-curve. For instance, the TV took like 50 years to get to everyone. Internet took a lot shorter than that. Mm-hmm. smartphones to get even shorter, and like the fastest adoption ever to reach a million, like if you go from zero to a billion people, I think it was Pokemon Go had the fastest. Like you just took a couple of weeks. I think
ChatGPT or AI now is.
Yeah. That's going insanely fast too. But so just for the sake of argument here, say that you have an S-shaped adoption curve for Bitcoin for people. Mm-hmm. Sure, that can follow an S curve, but that's not all the money. That's just all the people. Mm-hmm. There's still more money that can get into Bitcoin. So I see no end to hyper-Bitcoinization. Like, what's that point? Meaning that number can still go up forever and follow more of a J curve than an S curve. And with the upcoming SAT squeeze, I mean, 96% of the Bitcoin have already been mined. And the rest are going to be mined over, like, the remaining 5% or 4%, like, almost all of that is going to be mined during the next 10 years. And then there's 1% of the supply left to be mined over 120 years. And that's just mind-blowing to me how scarce they are and how this supply squeeze is going to, what that is going to do to the price. Because as more and more people hop on, because it's superior money. So it's if it just continues to work, it's adoption is inevitable. But the shape of the curve is not, like, it can still go. Number go up is one thing, but there might be a point in the future called number go absolutely bonkers. and that's when you get this snowball effect and all the fiat currencies start hyperinflating in comparison to Bitcoin, because central bankers around the world will print to acquire, because it's the only tool left in their toolbox, and everything else hyperinflates against Bitcoin and it just goes berserk. That may or may not happen. We don't know how far away that point is, but it's probably there.
The gradually then suddenly kind of
thing, yeah,
is what you're saying. In my mind, everything is already hyperinflated in Bitcoin terms. People just don't understand or realize it yet. I mean, if you graph a what we call Forex, like a Forex chart of like currencies, and like you graph Bitcoin and like USD, and like you kind of flip and you flip do USD in front in Bitcoin. I mean, it's down 99.99%, something insane.
The dollar is already hyperinflating, because extension of that is that every other currency is also hyperinflating, of course, because they inflate even faster than the dollar.
Can you explain Metcalfe's law?
Metcalfe's law states that the value of a communications network is equal to the square of its number of users. So just from that perspective alone, Bitcoin is exponentially more valuable with each user added onto it, because it's a communications network. It's like if you have two phones in a village, then you eat both phone owners have one person to call. And if you have three phones, all three people have two people to call. and so on and so forth. The value of the communications network grows exponentially. If you plot the users on a circle,
you have more,
and draw lines between the circles, you see all these possible paths it could take. And this is like one aspect of Bitcoin. The other is, you know, the absolutely finite supply and the scarcity and number going up because of that. But strictly from a Metcalfe's law perspective, it's more and more valuable, more and more usable the more users you have, and that grows exponentially.
So to summarize that, as the number, even if the numbers of users grows linearly, the amount of connections you can have between people on the network increases exponentially.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is why these types of networks, social media networks, et cetera, have communications networks, have exponentially increasing value with the more people that are on the network, because you can just have so many more connections between people.
Which also tells you something about Bitcoin versus shitcoins, because Bitcoin is exponentially more valuable. It's not a linear, like if you have 10 million Bitcoin users in the world and you have like 100,000 Or just for argument's sake, let's say that you have 10 million Bitcoin users and 5 million Ethereum users. Bitcoin is not double in value in comparison to Ethereum in terms of the value of the network, but it has grown exponentially from that point. So it's way, way, way more valuable from that, from Metcalfe's law perspective.
It'd be an interesting thing to look at to see which network between Bitcoin and Ethereum has more active users and people actually using it. Be interesting to think about.
There's something there. The same is true for social networks. Like the first mover advantage is extremely crucial.
But the first mover advantage is not everything. So that's if you look at MySpace as a social media network, it's non-existent, and Facebook really took over, right?
So, absolutely. But MySpace was very flawed as a social network. If I remember correctly, there wasn't even a feed. Like you just had to go to people's individual pages,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So there was I remember in middle school.
So I don't know if it even counts as a...
It was definitely a thing. It was like we would go there to find all the hot girls.
Yeah.
And we'd girls. Are you in your, who's in the top eight or whatever? I remember doing that, and you could message people on it and messaging girls on it. So that's, I definitely found
it. With social media, you have different... social media is not one thing. You can have different types of, Twitter is these 144 characters and good for text. Facebook is good for showing your boomer friends pictures of food. Instagram is good for people who want to share pictures. And TikTok is for hypnotizing kids with stupid cat videos. They have very different use cases.
I feel the exact same way about blockchains. I think Bitcoin is money, and then there's all these other things that you can do. That's how I interpret it and look at it. And I personally use them that.
Yeah. And you're free to, of course. It's this is just to say at being money. I'll try to be as friendly to shitcoins as I can here. Then they can maybe be other things. I am not very interested in that. They cannot be money.
I think that Bitcoin is really this sound money, and these other things can be useful for different things.
Yeah.
And they can have Pokemon cards, for example, have monetary characteristics, but they're not really money, but they have a value. They can be used for things, that's kind of the way that I think about a lot of these other things.
Yeah. And the other thing I can say positive about shitcoins is that it can to a certain extent be a testing ground for new things on Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Even though I don't really like that, because the biggest feature of Bitcoin is that it doesn't change, not that it changes. So and the market is always dynamic and subjective, so you can't really do empiricism in economics. However, there's some usefulness there. So if I'm being kind to shitcoins here.
Yeah, I've learned so much over the years being involved in different proof of work projects and things, and actually watching free markets form. I just find it fascinating to watch free market projects kind of form, and you can see what works, what doesn't work, some have more of a community and some have more network effect. It's fascinating. Interesting. It's like being an Austrian economics training ground. It's the last kind of frontier of the Wild West where you can see experiments happen and you can see learn different things.
But my point here is these are valuable things. A large part of what they are is valuable, they're supposed to be valuable, which is different, a value as a medium of exchange. You're supposed to be able to send value back and forth between people.
Yeah.
This was not true if you take Betamax versus VHS. They had a very another use case than being used as a medium of exchange. I'm just saying that game, the game of money, the game of being a common medium exchange, is a totally different game than CDs versus mini discs. It's not really comparable, because mini discs and CDs aren't a communications network. this is tied into Metcalfe's law, like the value of the network. Since it has exponential growth, it's the distance between the usefulness of the two is much wider than in other technologies for that very reason.
How do you see adoption playing out over the next decade or so? Do you think it's going to continue to be this steady grind of slowly growing adoption, or do you think like governments are going to somewhat not hyperinflate but print money? I mean, obviously they'll print anytime there's a crisis, but you know, people, and this is what I told Larry when we're talking, like he makes these predictions. It's like, you're right about everything, Larry, but like, look how many times they just they just like blow the bubble back up and keep everything going as per normal.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, the reason that fiat works to a certain extent is that we get so better at doing everything else.
Yeah.
So like the smartphone, for instance, made humanity so much better at doing stuff, mm-hmm. coordinating production, coordinating, transportation, coordinating communication, that prices have been able to stay relatively stable anyway. Like if we stopped developing technologies, the fiat would crash. And now the AI revolution is probably capable of keeping fiat alive for the next 10 years. Once again, it's more akin to rolling a snowball down a hill, though, mm-hmm. than kicking the can down the road. Like the more you postpone the inevitable fiat crash, the worse it will be. Mm-hmm. And if you rewind back to the era where Bitcoin was created, you know, that second brink on bailout for banks. This is the 2008 crisis, right? The Lehman Brothers thing. Mm-hmm. And what happened there was that the Democrats and the Republicans in the U.S., Obama and who was before Obama?
Bush.
Bush, yeah, Bush, Bush Jr. Bush and Obama colluded both parties decided that bailing out the banks was the good idea. Mm-hmm. Because and they shouldn't have. They should have, if they wanted the fiat economy to say survive for longer. They should have let the crash be there and let the people involved take the fall. Mm-hmm. Like that would have been the sound thing to do. But they didn't. They just kept on rolling this monetary snowball down the
crony
down
capitalism. The hill. They socialized the losses and they gave all these fuckers bonuses.
yeah, exactly. And they now we're in for a way 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 worse crisis. Mm-hmm. And the only lifeboat is Bitcoin.
What do we call this in Austrian economics? Is it creative destruction or what's that term?
Boom, bust, boom cycles. Yeah. And they don't happen unless there's central banking involved. Like you should read the Austrian theory the Great Depression.
Yeah. No, I'm well aware. I mean, that, like, you know, and I think it was Hayek that was predicted that and basically said, hey, if you do this, you're going to create, you know, like, there were boom and bust cycles, but they were just part of the economy. They were not serious, right? There would be a little bit of a problem. You'd have, you know, a boom and a recession, and that's just the market figuring it out. Yeah. But when they decided to create the central bank and started fucking with with the money and the interest rate and all this stuff, the price of money, they created this huge boom cycle, which obviously the Roaring Twenties, which was resulted in this epic bust, right?
Yeah. And they've managed to keep the bubble alive for longer this time around, but a crash is inevitable in my mind.
Yeah. I guess that is the prediction, and the question is kind of like when and what will they do when that time comes? Are they going to just print? I mean, I get the argument of Larry from his book is the big print. They're going to fucking print more money, like, which is what they've done every time.
It's the only option they got.
Yeah.
They cannot do anything else. And politicians, like, no, a politician's main incentive is to be reelected, mm-hmm. or to stay in power and not have. They are not incentivized to incentivize pitchforks and torches, running a lynch mob running after them. Right? They want to save their own skin. So the best option for the individual politician is always to keep rolling the snowball down the hill and give it to the next guy. And the next guy can take care of that.
It's like a game of musical chairs, essentially.
Yeah.
Find your chair and the next guy will find his chair. That's what it seems like. You talk a lot about the migration of intelligence to Bitcoin-friendly jurisdictions. What does that look like?
It's a brain drain. And you can see this all over the globe. Like countries that are friendly to unproductive people, they get what they pay for. They get unproductive people to come there and be unproductive. And it's true within countries too. Like in you know, San Francisco and Seattle, for instance, here you have really wealthy 20-year-olds in the tech sector sitting drinking frappe lattes from a paper straw while someone is dying from a meth overdose on the street. Like,
I got this black coffee. It's horrible.
Immigration problem in Europe. Like, at the same time, you have this effect that wealthy, clever people in the world that they move to jurisdictions that are more friendly to them. Bitcoiners move to places like El Salvador and Dubai and other jurisdictions that are more friendly to them. And this will continue.
We could see that on the data with all the debanking and choke point stuff that was happening in the US. You could see the developers going to like Singapore and all these other Asian countries and different places in the US. It was going down. And then now we've got a friendly jurisdiction or a friendly political party in power here. And as you see the opposite effect. So what you're describing is true. They're coming back now. You know?
That's the thing. You get what you pay for. If the people in charge incentivize one behavior, then that behavior is going to, people doing that thing is going to increase.
Part of the reason that I started this podcast is there's this famous expression, cypherpunks write code, right?
Yeah.
But there were a couple cypherpunks that kind of said, hey, like, that's great, but you know, we have to educate about these issues. And I'm not a technical person myself, so I figured, hey, that's a way that I can help. That's something that I can do to try to shine light on these things that, your books and other great authors in the space. What do you think, what advice would you give everybody? What can help adoption? And as a Bitcoiner, what is your, what can you do to help move freedom forward?
That's a great question. I think the most important thing is leading by example. Like, if you show the people around you that this actually works, you can actually live like this, it's better, and you can thrive doing this instead of staying in the fiat hamster's wheel, then you, leading by example is always better because people take notice. People talk about stuff all the time. People write books, people write articles. We're drowning in information, but if you can show your neighbors and if you can show the people around you that there is a way to get out of this debt trap and live a better life, and it's not scary, it's not dangerous, then that's probably the best thing you can do as an individual.
I think that's a good closing point for this episode. We'll be back with episode 11.
And so will Penny.